John writes in Revelation chapter 1, the very first verse, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants, things which must shortly take place. And he sent and signified it by his angel to his servant John. Things that were going to start to take place very soon, and those things were going to be shown by signs. Those are probably the two most important things when we come to the book of Revelation to realize. Those things were going to start taking place very soon, shortly, and it was going to be given in signs. Revelation in chapters 12 and 13, we've looked at the past few Sunday nights, chapters where we saw a great fiery red dragon, we saw a beast with seven heads and ten horns, we saw a beast rise up that had two small horns, and we talked about the significance of those, how important they were as far as identifying them. Of course, the great fiery red dragon is very explicitly said to be Satan, the devil, our adversary. The two beasts we looked at the past few weeks, the first beast, the more terrifying of the two, representing what's sometimes called pagan Rome or imperial Rome, the Roman government, the Roman emperors. And we talked especially about how terrible the emperor was toward the end of the first century, the time period in which the book of Revelation is written, and that is the emperor Domitian, and how wicked and evil the man was. The other beast rises up, the one that has the two little horns. We talked about the significance of that beast being, or that he was identified or was signified as, the religious part of Rome. The part of Rome that went and set up shrines and idols and altars to the Roman emperors. And basically, their job was to enforce emperor worship. Sometimes they were called the concilia. These were the ones that had the power from the government. They got their power, just like the second beast got it from the first beast. They got their power from the Roman government to enforce that. And they had power to kill. They had power to imprison. They had power to torture. They had power, as we talked about last week, to cause economic problems for those people who would not bow down to emperor worship. So chapters 12 and 13 were somewhat dark, but there was still a message of hope in it. Revelation 14 now is revealed, this vision, as a vision of hope, as a vision of triumph, as a vision of victory. And that's how Revelation 14 begins. Then I looked, and behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his father's name written on their foreheads. There is how it begins, a much brighter picture than the last two chapters. There's the Lamb who's already been identified as the Christ, the Messiah, as Jesus. And he's pictured there standing up, and he's on Mount Zion. Zion is a very interesting word as you trace it throughout the Bible. In the Old Testament, it was almost exclusively used for the city of Jerusalem. And that city came to be known as Zion. In a lot of places, that's what it's called. In the New Testament, we come down and Mount Zion is often referring to the church. The redeemed, especially, of the church, of this gospel age. Here, as we'll see in the first few verses, it seems to indicate more of heaven. And we'll see why in a minute. Because when the book of Revelation is written, of course, where's the Lamb? The Lamb's in heaven, sitting at the right hand of the throne of God. Had been resurrected some, 50 years or more before this is written, and been in heaven, reigning over His kingdom as the King, as the one who is in control, as the Lord, as the ruler. And so there He's pictured standing on Mount Zion. But He's not alone. There are 144,000 who are with Him, and these are identified as the ones that have their Father's name written on their foreheads. Recall in the last couple of chapters, those who were following pagan Rome and the wickedness associated with them had a sign on them too, had a seal on them, on their foreheads, but it was because they were sinful and wicked. This sign, this seal on their foreheads of these represents the ones who are redeemed, the ones who are of God, who are following God, who are not bowing down to the emperor and to his idols, but who are being faithful. And as this section ends, even to death. So these are the ones who were redeemed, 144,000. As we've all talked in here over the past several months, this book, as John says in the very first verse, comes about with signs. He uses signs, figures of speech. He certainly uses one here. 144,000 is sometimes used by some religious groups as a literal number. And Wednesday night we'll be talking about one of those groups that believe that is a literal number. And we'll see why that cannot be true. It's impossible for that number to be taken literally, as we'll see when we get down a few verses. 144,000 certainly represents a great multitude. In many ways, it's a perfect number. 12 times 12, we know what that number is, 144. And then when the 1,000 is put on it, it makes it even more perfect, more complete. And so these are all represented as the redeemed, those who are saved, those who are sanctified, those who are of God. And that's the term or the number that is used. And certainly no reason for us to take that as a literal number, and we'll see why. What happens? John hears a voice from heaven. This voice, verse 2, is like the voice of many waters. It's like the voice of loud thunder. And I heard the sound of harpists playing their harps. They sang, as it were, a new song before the throne, before the four living creatures and the elders. And no one could learn that song except the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth. Well, we have a little clearer definition of the 144,000. They're obviously not angels, are they? These are not angels. These are redeemed where? From the earth. So these are ones who lived and died on the earth. These were people who were, again, those who were redeemed, those who were sanctified, those who belonged to God, who lived and walked on earth. So these aren't angels, the 144,000. These are people who are singing a new song, and it's a song primarily of victory, isn't it? You know, there's a lot of songs that we sing that angels couldn't sing, right? Think about all the songs we sing that angels couldn't sing. Any song that had to do with sin, angels couldn't sing because they have no really comprehension of what it means to sin. We do. So angels don't know what it means to be redeemed either, because someone has to have sinned before they can be redeemed. This is a song, though, that the redeemed are singing, the 144,000 who were redeemed from the earth, and it is a, we might call it a victory song, and they're singing it right there before the throne. There's a lot of sounds he hears, sound of many waters, great, you know, powerful, loud thunder, again, powerful. It's a beautiful song, but it's one that only these could possibly sing. And so these are that are singing are representative of all of these, all of those who are redeemed. And certainly going to be far more than 144,000 that will end up being redeemed someday. Who are they? This is how he gives us more and more information as we go into this section about who they are. And he says in verse 4, these are the ones who what? Were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These are the ones who follow the Lamb wherever He goes. These were redeemed from among men, being first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Now there we're given some real clues to their identity, right? These 144,000 that are singing this new song before the Lamb, before the throne, before the elders, before the angels, they are virgins. And with the exception of just a very, very few, nobody takes this literal. With the exception of few, some do. So these 144,000, if you're going to take the 144,000 literal, if you're going to be a good, sound, trustworthy Bible student, you're going to have to take the virgins literally as well. But hardly anybody will do that. Well, that's not good. That's not good Bible interpretation. Taking one literal and the other figurative. Of course, they're both in signs, right? John said he's going to present it in signs. He's going to present it in figures of speech, symbols. 144,000 was a symbol. The virgins are a symbol. Why is it a symbol, and what's it a symbol of? Well, we go back and look at it through the first century glasses, and we understand what it's a symbol of. The Christians were living in a very pagan, idolatrous area. All around them, everywhere they looked, there were pagan religions that bowed down to idols. And even within, of course, Rome itself, the Roman government, people were bowing down to idols. These, those who are redeemed, the 144,000, did not do that, did not commit spiritual adultery. So they are virgins, but they're spiritual ones. So they have not given up themselves to pagan religions and pagan gods. They have been faithful to Jehovah. They've been faithful to Jesus. They're not bowing down to those other gods. And they're not bowing down to the emperor. So they are spiritual virgins. It's a symbol, just like the 144,000. They've not been defiled with women. They are spiritually pure. They're the ones who follow the Lamb. They're the ones who follow Jesus wherever He goes. Doesn't make any difference. They're following Him. Regardless of the circumstances, they're following Him. They were redeemed from among men. These were men. They walked the earth and lived, of course, just like anybody else. These are considered to be the first fruits to God and to the Lamb. Maybe the significance of that is that there will be more who don't bow down and who follow the Lamb and are spiritual virgins. These are the ones that rightfully belong before the throne singing a song because they've been faithful, they've been pure, they've followed the Lamb. They're the ones that deserve to stand before the throne. The ones who renounced Jesus to save their lives or the ones that didn't believe in the first place, they have no right to stand before the throne and sing a new song. Only these who are faithful. He further describes in verse 5, and in their mouth was found no deceit or no guile, for they are without fault before the throne of God. Now they're further described. They have no guile. They don't deceive. They don't tell lies. You know, some in the first century would, when they were told, if you don't bow down and worship the emperor, you know, you'll be thrown in prison, you'll be killed, whatever. Some of them would do just that. They would bow down to the emperor. They may not have believed it, but they bowed down anyway. Not these. There's no deceit in them. There's no guile in them. They're honest. They tell the truth. And what? They're found without fault before the throne of God, without blemish before the throne of God. That's how these people are seen to be. You know, they've refused to bow down to the emperor. They've refused to confess Caesar as Lord. And as a result, they don't have any spiritual or moral or ethical blemish. Again, that's why they can rightfully stand before the throne. They've been redeemed by the Lamb. There's the 144,000. And think about what that would have meant, again, to the Christians in the first century. They're being told, look, if you're faithful and you don't bow down and you don't confess Caesar as Lord and you continue to follow the Lamb, what are you going to do? You're going to be before the throne singing a new song, a song of victory. The Lamb's victorious, you're going to be victorious. We went through two relatively dark chapters where Satan and the beast were seen to be going after God's people. Now this chapter says Christ is victorious and all those who follow Him are victorious. Jesus is in heaven. You're going to be in heaven. Some were already there. Some had already been martyred. Some had already been killed because of their faith. They had been faithful to the point of death and they were there. In the sense of they were seen as being before the throne. And again, not literally before the throne, but that's how they're pictured. They were in a place of paradise. They were in a place where there was no more persecution. They were in a place where there was no more suffering. They were in a place where Satan and the beast could no longer bother them in any way. Why? Because they were faithful. So that's why they're pictured as being before the throne. They deserve that. They followed the Lamb. They were redeemed. So it's a great picture of being victorious. Being victorious someday. One day, they would get to stand before the throne and sing a song of praise and victory because they were faithful in this life. That's why it meant so much to the people in the first century, didn't it? It was a song of victory. He goes on, the next portion begins in verse 6. He sees another angel. He's flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those who dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, "Fear God and give glory to Him, for the hour of His judgment has come, and worship Him who made heaven and earth, the sea, and springs of water." So this angel is seen to be what? He has the everlasting gospel, the gospel of Jesus Christ. And what's it to do? To preach to those who dwell on the earth. Everybody, regardless of where they live and what language they speak and their background, the everlasting gospel is to everybody. No exceptions. And here's what it says. First, you're to fear God. Number two, you're to give glory to God. And you're to worship God. Fear God, give glory to God, worship God. Doesn't that really kind of just sum up what Christians are to do? And if you, regardless of whether you lived in the first century or now, that's being faithful. You're revering God. You're holding God in reverence and in awe. By your actions, you're bringing glory to God by how you live and what you do and what you say. And then you worship God, the one who made all the world. And that kind of sums up the Christian's life. Those people who are redeemed, those people who will get to stand before the throne and sing the new song, are those people who fear God, bring glory to God, and worship God. And they're the ones who have listened to the everlasting gospel and followed it. And it is, as he says, good news. But there's some bad news in the next verse, but not for God's people. And another angel followed, saying, "Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." Slightly different message, isn't it? There was judgment coming to Babylon, and it's so certain. And the Bible does this a lot in prophecies in the Old Testament as well as the New. It's so certain because God's going to bring about, even though it actually hasn't happened, it is said to have already happened because it is absolutely certain that it's going to happen. So he says Babylon is fallen. It hadn't fallen yet. The Roman government was still there and it was still in power and it was still persecuting people. But it was so certain that God was going to bring it down, destroy it, that it's spoken of as already having happened. You see this so much in the Old Testament, where it's declared through one of the prophets that something has happened. It hadn't happened yet. Some of the things didn't happen for years and years and years, but it was so certain that it was going to happen that it's spoken of as being in the past tense. Well, so it is here. Babylon is fallen. That Roman government that was the source of evil for all those Christians was going down. And again, if you were living in the first century, as a Christian, you want to hear that. You want to know that these persecutors, the ones who are killing your friends or causing them to be imprisoned and tortured and everything else, that they are going to be destroyed. That would give you hope. And so that's what he says. And it's spoken of as already done. It's fallen, that great city. Why? Because she's made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And of course, Rome did that, the Roman Empire. It was a worldwide empire, and it forced nations that it took over to be a part of that. And so because she did that, they, of course, were a part of that judgment as well. Another angel appears. Then a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, "If anyone worships the beast in the image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He should be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever. And they have no rest day or night, who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name." Here is a different mark put on individuals for a different reason. Either the forehead or the hand. It was for those people who were following the beast, who were following Satan. Their end, and here he's obviously talking about the final end, the final judgment, in the words that he uses, he says they are going to feel the full strength of God's anger. Everybody that is punished in Gehenna eternally is going to feel the full strength of God's anger. And as it says here, they will be tormented day and night forever. Why? Because they didn't follow the Lamb. They chose to follow Satan, and that's how they lived their entire life. And they're going to feel it. They're going to feel that wrath, full strength. Not diluted, you know, like they would often do at different times and still do, I guess, with alcoholic drinks or of any type of drink. They would dilute it, be weaker. Here he says there's no diluted here. It's full strength. Full potency, and they're going to feel it forever. He should be tormented with fire and brimstone. The people in the first century, especially if you lived around volcanoes, and there's all kinds of volcanoes, especially in the area where those seven cities were located. You know, Turkey is one of the areas in the world that has earthquakes and all kinds of things like that. Well, there's volcanoes in parts of the Roman Empire. They experienced earthquakes. And often with volcanoes anyway, you would have brimstone, sulfur. And sulfur gas, when it goes into the atmosphere, is a choking type of gas. It's like you can't get your breath. And he says that's how he's describing those who are going to be tormented. With fire and brimstone. And those people, again, who lived in that part of the world, in the Roman Empire, if they didn't live near volcanoes and so forth, they knew about people who did and knew what they could do. And that's one of the worst things about volcanoes. It's often worse than the hot magma, is the poisonous gases that are given off. And he says they're going to feel it, fire and brimstone, in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment ascends again forever, unending. And they have no rest ever. Why? Because they worshiped the beast and his image, and they received his mark. Terrifying end for those people. Absolutely terrifying. And just to have imagined, you know, again, depending on where they lived, some of them would have known a lot more about volcanoes than other places, but there were lots of volcanoes in that Roman Empire. And they would have known what it meant to experience fire, the heat from it, the destruction from it, the noxious fumes of sulfur. They would have known all of that. and that it would be tormenting day and night. But he ends up this section, and so will we, by saying, here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. He describes them again. Here are the saints. Who are they? They're the ones who keep the commandments of God. Even though the saints, especially in the first century, were going to suffer, they were only going to suffer for a while. But those people who didn't follow the commandments of God, who bowed down to the idols and worshipped the emperors, those people, they were going to suffer, but it was going to be forever, unending. So there's the patience of the saints. And that's how they were going to win their souls, as Jesus says in Luke 21. In your patience, you shall win your souls. And he ends up by saying, then I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. That's how he ends up this. Not only will those people in the first century who were faithful, who didn't confess Caesar as Lord, but who would not bow down to false gods and false idols, there were going to be others coming later. And so those of us who try to do the same thing, follow the commandments of the Lord, confess Jesus, and don't bow down to any other type of idols, then we're going to join them someday. And someday, after Jesus comes and the judgment, then we're all the redeemed will be standing there before the throne, praising God, worshiping God, as we'll see in the very last chapter, Revelation 22. Praising, worshiping, serving forever. And that's how he ends. And he says, you'll be able to rest from your labors, and their works follow them. Our works will follow us. That's what it says. Our works important? And it says here they are. They're very important. They're critical about where we're going to spend eternity. It makes a difference how we live. Once we become a Christian, it makes a difference how we live. And John here, through inspiration, says so. Only those who die in the Lord, in His body, those who through faith have been baptized, Galatians 3, 26 and 27, that places us in the Lord. But then we must be faithful, as he says, and die in the Lord. And then we'll be able to sing that victory song someday as well, with all the redeemed standing before the throne forever. Hopefully this lesson has made us all think about our life and our faithfulness and our works and how we are living. And maybe someone needs to respond. And if they do, I encourage you to come as we stand and sing this next song.